leave it in a locker, and she would not bother entering with her laptop or cell phone, because these would be taken from her immediately if they were on her person. She knew to wear comfortable shoes, because she would be walking from the administration unit to her prisoner's cell, a journey of hundreds of yards of hallways and covered outdoor walkways, and she made sure to dress in an especially conservative pantsuit, so that the warden would not refuse her entry due to the preposterous accusation of provocative attire. She also knew she'd be going through x-ray machines and full-body scanners, so she followed prison rules for visitors and wore a bra that was free of underwire. She drove on past the guard shack, past a long, high wall. She looped around to the south and went through more remote gates, and as she drove slowly, she encountered more guard towers, shotguns, assault rifles, German shepherds, and security cameras than she could possibly count. Finally, she pulled into a large, half-empty parking lot outside the administration wing. Behind her, at the entrance to the lot, a row of bright yellow hydraulically operated spikes rose from slats in the concrete. She would not be leaving until the guard force here was ready for her to leave. Judith Cochran was met at her car door by a female guard, and together they walked through a series of secure doors and hallways in the administrative wing of the prison. There was no conversation between the two, and the guard did not offer to help the much older woman carry her briefcase or pull her laptop bag. "Lovely morning," Judith Cochran said as they marched down a clean white passageway. The guard ignored her comment but continued to lead the way with professionalism. Most guards at ADX Florence didn't think much of the attorneys who defended the prisoners incarcerated here. Cochran didn't care. She could schlep her own bags, and she'd long ago decided that she much preferred the company of the inmates of Supermax prisons to the guard force, who were, as far as she was concerned, just uneducated thugs. Her worldview was as bleak and cruel as it was simple. Prison guards were like soldiers, who were like police, who were like any federal agent who wielded a gun. They were the bad guys. After graduating and passing the bar in California, Judith Cochran was hired by the Center for Constitutional Rights, a legal advocacy group that focused on civil rights cases. After a few years of this, she went into private practice, and she'd worked some high-profile cases, including serving as a junior lawyer on the legal team that defended Patty Hearst on bank robbery charges. After that, she worked for the ACLU for a dozen years, and then Human Rights Watch for several more. When Paul Laska funded the development of the Progressive Constitution Initiative, he'd recruited her personally to join the well-bankrolled Liberal Judicial Advocacy Group. He didn't have to work too hard at getting her. Cochran was thrilled to take a job that let her pick and choose her cases. Almost immediately after the startup of the organization, the attacks of September 11, 2001 occurred. And to Judith Cochran and her co-workers, that meant something truly terrible. She knew a witch hunt by the American government was on the horizon. Christians and Jews against Muslims. For more than half a decade, Cochran was asked to appear on hundreds of television programs to talk about the evils of the U.S. government. She did as many appearances as she could while still defending her clients. But when Ed Kuelty was elected president, Judith Cochran suddenly found herself blacklisted. She was surprised that the networks didn't seem to care as much about civil rights when Kuelty and his men ran the FBI, the CIA, and the Pentagon as they had during the Ryan years. These days, with Kuelty in the White House, Cochran had as much time as she needed to work on her cases. She was unmarried with no children, and her work was her life. She had developed many close personal relationships with her clients, relationships that could never lead to anything more than emotional closeness, as virtually all of her clients were separated from her by plexiglass windows or iron bars. She was also married, in the figurative sense, to her convictions, a lifelong love affair with her beliefs. And it was these convictions that brought her here to Supermax to meet with Saif Yassin. She was led into the warden's office, where the warden shook her hand and introduced her to a large black man in a starched blue uniform. "This is the unit commander for H. He will take you to Range 13 and to the FBI detail in charge of your prisoner. We don't have actual custody of prisoner 09341-000. We are essentially just the holding facility."
"I understand. Thank you," she said as she shook the uniformed man's hand. "We'll be seeing a lot of each other."
The unit commander replied professionally, "Ms. Cochran, this is just a formality, but we have our rules. May I see your state bar card?" She reached into her purse and handed it over. The unit commander looked it over and handed it back to her. The warden said,
This prisoner will be handled differently. I assume you have a copy of his special administrative measures, as well as the directives for your meetings with him?
I have both of those documents. As a matter of fact, I have a team of attorneys preparing our response to them.
Your response?
Yes. We will be suing you shortly, but you must have known that already.
Well, I...
Cochrane smiled thinly. Don't worry. For today I promise to oblige your illegal Sams. The unit commander was taken aback, but the warden stepped in. He'd known Judith Cochrane long enough to remain unfazed, no matter what she said or accused him of.
We appreciate that. Originally we had planned to have you meet with him via video visiting, like our other special housing unit inmates. But the AG said you absolutely refused that arrangement.
I did. This man is in a cage, I understand that. But I need to have some rapport with him if I am to do my job. I can't communicate with him on a television screen.
The unit commander said, We will take you to his cell. You will communicate to the prisoner via a direct phone line. It is not monitored. This has been ordered by the Attorney General himself.
Very good.
We have a desk for you outside his cell. There is a partition of bulletproof glass. This will serve as an attorney-client visiting booth, just like if you were meeting with one of your other clients in the visitation center.
She signed papers in the warden's office, putting her name to agreements that had been worked up by the Justice Department and the Bureau of Prisons regarding what she could and couldn't say to the prisoner, what he could and couldn't say to her. As far as she was concerned, it was all bullshit. But she signed it so she could get started on the man's defense. She'd worry about it later, and she'd violate her agreement if it was in the best interest of her client. Hell, she'd sued the Bureau of Prisons many times before. She was not going to let them tell her how she would represent her client. Together, she and the unit commander left the administration building, walked under a covered walkway to another wing of the prison. She was ushered through more locked doors, and on the other side she walked through an X-ray scanner just like those at airport security. On the other side of the scanner, a set of doors opened, and here she was met by two men in black body armor and black ski masks with rifles.
Oh dear, she said. Is all this really necessary?
The unit commander stopped at the door. He said,
I have my responsibilities, and they end right here at the threshold of Range 13. You are now in the care of the FBI, who are operating the annex that houses your prisoner.
The unit commander extended a polite hand, and she shook it without really looking at him. Then she turned away, ready to follow the federal officers. The FBI escorted her inside, and here they put her purse in a locker on the wall of the stark white room, then walked her through a full-body scanner. On the other side of this, she was handed a legal pad and a single, soft-tip marking pen, and then led through two sets of security doors that were monitored by closed-circuit cameras. Once through these, she found herself in an anteroom outside the recently modified cell. In front of her were four more armed HRT men. The lead FBI SWAT officer spoke with a thick Brooklyn accent.
You understand the rules, Ms. Cochrane? You sit in the chair at the desk and talk on the phone to your client. Your conversations will be private. We will be right outside the door and we can watch you on CCTV, but there is no microphone in this room or in the prisoner's cell.
He handed her a small button that looked like her garage door opener. Panic button, he explained.
The prisoner couldn't get through that glass with a Gatling gun, so there's nothing to worry about. But if he does something that makes you feel uneasy, just press that button.
Cochrane nodded. She hated these smug men with their dehumanizing rules, their heinous weapons of hate, and their cowardly masks. Still, she was professional enough to feign kindness.
Wonderful. Thank you for your help. I'm sure I'll be just fine.
She turned away from the guard and looked around the room. She saw the window that looked into the cell, and she saw a wheeled desk that had been put there on this side for her benefit. A telephone was on it, but she was not satisfied.
Officers, there should be a pass-through slot in the plexiglass in case I need him to look at documents or sign something.
The HRT officer in charge shook his head.
Sorry, ma'am. There is a hatch for us to send his food and clothing through, but it is locked up for your visit. You'll have to talk to the warden about that for next time.
And with that, the HRT men, all four of them, backed through the door and shut it with a loud clang. Judith Cochrane stepped to the little table by the glass and sat down, placed her pad in her lap with her pen, and only then did she look into the cell. Saif Rahman Yassin sat on his concrete bed, facing the portal. He'd been reading from a Quran that he gently placed on the desk at the foot of the bed. When Cochrane looked to him, he took off his prison-issued eyeglasses and rubbed his eyes. And Judith immediately thought of a younger Omar Sharif.
He stood and crossed the small cell toward her, sat down on a three-legged stool that had been placed next to a telephone on the floor. Judith noticed the red phone had no buttons or dials. It would connect him only with the receiver in her hand. Yassin lifted the telephone off the cradle and held it to his ear tentatively. He kept his face impassive, looked the woman in the eye, as if waiting for her to speak.
"Good morning, Mr. Yassin. My name is Judith Cochran. I am told you speak excellent English. Is my information correct?"
The prisoner said nothing, but Cochran could tell he understood her. She'd worked almost exclusively with those whose native language was other than her own, and she had no trouble discerning either recognition or befuddlement. She continued,
"I am an attorney for the Progressive Constitution Initiative. U.S. Attorney General Michael Branigan has decided that your case will be handled in U.S. District Court for the Western District of Virginia. The AG's office will be preparing the prosecution against you, and my organization has been retained to provide you with your defense. Do you understand me so far?"
She waited a moment for a response, but the man known as Prisoner 09341-000 just stared back at her.
"We can expect this to be a lengthy process, certainly over a year in duration, likely closer to 2 years. Before that can even begin, there are several preliminary steps we need to..."
"I would like to speak with someone from Amnesty International about my illegal imprisonment."
Cochran nodded sympathetically but said,
"I am afraid I am not in a position to make that happen. I assure you that I am working in your interests, and the first order of business will be to assess the conditions of your confinement so that you are afforded proper care and treatment."
The emir just repeated himself.
"I would like to speak with someone from Amnesty International about my illegal imprisonment."
"Sir, you are lucky that you are speaking to anyone at all."
"I would like to speak to someone from Amnesty International about my..."
Cochran sighed. "Mr. Yassin, I know your playbook. One of your manuals was picked up by American Special Forces soldiers in Kandahar a few years ago. It laid out, in minute detail, instructions for dealing with capture and captivity. I knew you would ask for a representative of Amnesty International. I am not with Amnesty International, true, but I am with an organization that will be much more beneficial to you in the long run."
Yassin stared at her for a long moment, holding the receiver to his ear. Then he spoke again, altering the script.
"You have given that speech before."
"Indeed. I have represented many men and one or two women that the United States has labeled enemy combatants. Every last one of you has read that manual.
You may be the first person I've spoken to who likely wrote some of the manual."
She smiled when she said this. Yassin did not respond. Cochran continued,
"I understand how you must feel. Don't talk for now. Just listen to what I have to say. The President of the United States and the Attorney General have personally spoken with the Director of the Bureau of Prisons to stress how important it is that you have confidential conversations with your legal team."
My what?"
"Your legal team. Myself and other attorneys from PCI, that is the Progressive Constitution Initiative, who you will meet in the coming months."
The emir did not speak.
"I'm sorry. Are you having trouble understanding me? Should I arrange for a translator?"
The emir understood the woman perfectly. It wasn't the English language that was slowing down his portion of the conversation. It was, rather, his astonishment that the Americans were, after all this time, going to put him on trial. He stared at the fat woman with the short gray hair. She looked to him like a man, a very ugly man, who dressed in women's clothing. He smiled at her slowly. Saif Rahman Yassin had long known that it was only the fool's luck of geography that the United States of America had survived 200-plus years on this earth. If these imbeciles had their nation lifted out of their hemisphere and dropped into the center of the Middle East, with their childlike acquiescence to those who would do them harm, they would not survive a single year.
"Miss, are you saying that there is no one listening to what we say?"
"No one, Mr. Yassin."
The emir shook his head and grunted.
"Preposterous."
"I assure you, you can speak freely with me."
"That would be insane."
"We have a constitution that allows you some rights, Mr. Yassin. It's what makes my country great. Unfortunately, the climate in my country is against people of color, people of other races and religious beliefs. For this reason, you are not afforded all the benefits of our constitution. But still, you get some.
You have the right to confidential meetings with your legal counsel.
He saw now that she was telling the truth, and he fought back a smile.
Yes, that is what makes your country great. It is populated with fools like you.
Very well, he said. What would you like to talk about?
Today, only the conditions of your confinement. The warden and the FBI team in charge of your custody have shown me the special administrative measures that you are under. They tell me that when you arrived here, all your rules were explained to you.
The emir said, it was worse in the other places.
Cochrane raised a small, wrinkled hand. Okay, now is probably a good time to go through some of our ground rules. I can go into more detail when we actually begin working on your case, but for now, I will just say that I am not allowed to record any detail of your capture or detainment before you arrived here at ADX Florence 3 months ago. In fact, I am required to inform you that you are not allowed to tell me about anything that happened before you were transferred into federal custody from...
She chose her next words carefully.
From where you came from before.
I am not allowed?
I'm afraid not.
Yassin shook his head slowly, incredulously.
And what will my punishment be if I violate that arrangement?
He winked at the woman in front of him.
Will they put me in jail?
Judith Cochrane laughed. Quickly she caught herself. I can understand that this is a unique situation. The government is making this up as they go along. They are having some growing pains in deciding how to handle your situation. They have a track record of trying so-called enemy combatants in federal court, though, and I can assure you my organization will hold the Attorney General's office to high standards during your trial.
ADX Florence. Is that what this place is called?
Yes, I'm sorry. I should have known that was not clear to you. You are in a federal prison in Colorado. Anyway, tell me about your treatment here.
He held her gaze as he said,
my treatment here is better than my treatment at the other places.
Cochrane gave another sympathetic nod, a gesture she'd made a million times in her long career of defending the indefensible.
I'm sorry, Mr. Yassin. That part of your ordeal will never be a part of our discussions.
And why is that?
We had to agree to this condition in order to be allowed access to you. Your time in U.S. custody is divided, and the dividing line is the moment you came here, the moment you entered the federal system. Everything before that, I assume, involved the U.S. military and intelligence community, and that will not be part of your defense. If we force this issue at all, the Department of Justice will just remand you back to military custody, and you will be sent to Guantanamo Bay, and God knows what will happen to you there.
The emir thought this over for a few moments and then said, very well.
Now then, how often are you allowed to bathe?
To bathe?
What madness is this, thought the emir. If a woman asked him this in the Pakistani tribal regions where he'd spent much of the past few years, she would be flogged to death surrounded by a crowd of gleeful onlookers. Yes, I need to know about your hygiene, whether or not your physical needs are being met. The bathroom facilities, are they acceptable to you?
In my culture, Judith Cochrane, it is not proper for a man to discuss this with a woman.
She nodded. I understand. This is not comfortable for you. It is awkward for me, but I assure you, Mr. Yassin, I am working in your interest.
There is no reason for you to be interested in my toilet habits. I want to know what you will do about my trial.
Cochrane smiled. As I said, it is a slow process. Immediately we will petition for a writ of habeas corpus. This is a demand that you be taken before the judge, who will then determine if the prison system has the authority to hold you. The writ will be denied, it won't go anywhere, it never does, but it puts the system on notice that we will vigorously attend to your case.
Miss Cochrane, if you were vigorous about defending me, you would listen to my explanation of how I was captured. It was wholly illegal.
I told you, that is off limits by agreement with the Justice Department.
Why would they do that? Because they have something to hide?
Of course they have something to hide. There is no legal justification for the United States kidnapping of you. I know that, and you know that. But that is what happened. She sighed. If I am going to represent you, you are going to have to trust me. Can you please do that for me?
The emir looked at her face. It was imploring, sincere, earnest. Ridiculous. He would play along for now.
I would like a paper and pencil. I would like to make some sketches.
Sketches? Why?
Just to pass the time.
She nodded, looked around the room. I think I can persuade DOJ that that is a reasonable request. I will get to work on that as soon as I get back to my hotel.
Thank you.
You are welcome. Now, recreation. I would like to hear about what your recreation consists of. Would you care to talk about that?
I would prefer we talk about the torture I endured at the hands of American spies.
Cochran folded her notebook with another long sigh. I will be back in 3 days. Hopefully by then you will have something to sketch with and some paper. I should be able to manage that with a letter to the Attorney General. In the meantime, think about what I've told you today. Think about our ground rules. But also, please think about ways you can benefit from a trial. You need to consider this as an opportunity for you and your cause. You can, with my help, stick a finger in the eye of the American government. Wouldn't you like that?
And you have helped others stick their fingers in the eye of America?
Cochran smiled proudly.
Many times, Mr. Yassin.
I told you, I have a lot of experience in this.
You told me you have a lot of clients in prison. That is not experience that I find particularly impressive in an attorney.
Now she spoke defensively.
Those clients are in prison, but they are not on death row. And they are not in a military stockade, unlike a lot of others. The Supermax prison is not the worst fate.
Martyrdom is preferred.
Well, I won't help you with that. If you want to be dragged into a dark corner of this place and given a lethal injection, you manage that on your own. But I know men like you, Mr. Yassin. That's not what you want.
The emir kept a faint smile on his lips, but it was just for show. In his head, he was thinking,
No, Judith Cochran, you do not know any man like me.
But when he spoke, he said, I am sorry I have not been more pleasant. I have forgotten my manners in the many months since my last conversation with a kind soul.
The 61-year-old American woman melted in front of him. She even leaned forward toward the glass partition, closing the distance between the two of them.
I will make things better for you, Saif Rahman Yassin.
Just trust me. Let me get to work on the paper and pencil. Perhaps I can arrange a little privacy for you, or a little more space. As I tell my clients, this will always be a prison, not paradise, but I will make it better.
I understand that. Paradise awaits me. This is merely the waiting room. I would choose it to be more luxurious, but the suffering I endure now will only serve me in paradise.
That's one way to look at it, Judith Cochran smiled. I'll see you in 3 days.
Thank you, Miss Cochran.
The emir cocked his head and smiled.
I am sorry, how rude. Is it Mrs. or Miss?
I am unmarried, replied Judith, warmth filling her fleshy cheeks and jowls.
Yassin smiled.
I see.
24. Jack Ryan Jr. arrived at Liberty Crossing, the name given the campus of the National Counterterrorism Center, just after 11 a.m. He had a lunch date with Mary Pat Foley, but Mary Pat asked him to come early for a personal tour of the building. At first, Mary Pat had suggested she and Jack dine at the restaurant there at NCTC after the tour. But Jr. had made clear that there would be a business component to the lunch, and for that reason, he preferred they went someplace off-site and quiet where they could talk shop. Mary Pat Foley was the only person at Liberty Crossing who knew of the existence of the campus, and Jack wanted to keep it that way. Jack pulled to the front gate in his yellow H3. He showed his ID to a tough-looking guard, who checked his name off a list of approved visitors on his computer. The guard waved the Hummer through, and Jack continued on to his meeting with the number 2 NCTC executive. She met him in the lobby, helped him get his credentials, and together they shot up an elevator to the operations center. This was Mary Pat's realm, and she made certain to spend a portion of each day walking among the analysts working here, making herself available to anyone who needed a moment of the deputy director's time. The room was impressive. There were dozens of workstations facing several large wall displays. The huge open space amazed Ryan. He couldn't help but compare it to his own shop, which, although possessing state-of-the-art technology, did not look nearly as cool as the NCTC's setup. Still, Jack realized, he and his fellow analysts were privy to virtually every bit of intelligence that flashed across the monitors around him. Mary Pat enjoyed the role of tour guide for young Ryan, as she explained that more than 16 agencies work together here at the National Counterterrorism Center, compiling, prioritizing, and analyzing data that came to it from intelligence sources across the U.S. intelligence community, as well as directly from foreign partners. This ops center, she explained, was up and running 24/7, and she was proud of its impressive feat of coordination in a bureaucracy such as the U.S. federal government. Mary Pat did not bother any of the analysts working at their desks as she and Jack wove through the busy operations center. If each person in the room had to stop what they were doing each time a VIP was ushered by, little important work would get done. But she did direct Jack to a workstation near the hallway that led to her office. Here Jack noticed a gorgeous girl about his age, with mid-length dark hair and a ponytail. Mrs. Foley finished her spiel on the virtues of interagency cooperation with a shrug. That's how it's supposed to work, anyway. We do pretty well most of the time, but like anything else, we are only as good as the data we analyze. Better product means better conclusions. Jack nodded. It was the same with him. He was looking forward to getting out of the building so he could share with Mary Pat the excellent product he had brought with him. Thanks for the tour.
You bet. Let's go eat. But first, I'd like you to meet someone.
Great, said Jack, and he caught himself hoping it was the good-looking girl busy at her desk right next to them.
Melanie, do you have a second?
To Ryan's pleasure, the girl with the chestnut hair stood and turned around. She wore a light blue button-down shirt and a navy knee-length pencil skirt. Jack saw a navy jacket over the back of her swivel chair.
Jack Ryan Jr., meet Melanie Kraft. She's my newest star here at the Ops Center.
The two shook hands with smiles. Melanie said,
Mary Pat, when I joined, you didn't tell me I would get to meet celebrities.
Junior's not a celebrity, he's family.
Ryan groaned inwardly at being called Junior in front of this girl. Jack thought she was stunning. He had a hard time turning away from her bright, friendly eyes. Melanie nodded and said,
You're taller than you look on TV.
Jack smiled. I haven't been on TV in years. I've grown up a bit, I guess.
Mary Pat said, Jack, I kidnapped Melanie from her desk at Langley.
Thank goodness for that, Melanie said.
You couldn't work for a better boss, Jack replied with a smile, or do more important work than NCTC.
Thanks. Are you here because you were planning on following in your dad's footsteps in government service?
Jack chuckled. No, Mary Pat and I have a lunch date. I'm not here looking for work. I appreciate what you guys do, but I'm a money guy. A greedy capitalist, you might say.
Nothing wrong with that, as long as you pay your taxes. My salary has to come from somewhere.
They all three laughed about that.
Well, I'd better get back to work, Melanie said. It was nice meeting you. Best of luck to your father next month. We're rooting for him.
Thank you. I know he appreciates what you all do here.
Mary Pat had just shut the door on Ryan's Hummer. He had not even turned over the engine when she turned to him and smiled. He smiled back.
Something on your mind, Mary Pat?
She's single.
Jack laughed.
With a slight affectation in his voice, he said, I have no idea what you were talking about.
Mary Pat Foley just smiled.
You'd like her. She's very smart.
No, not smart. I think she's damn brilliant. Ed and I have already had her over to dinner, and Ed is smitten.
Great, Jack said.
He did not get embarrassed particularly easily, but he was starting to blush.
He'd known Mary Pat since he'd been in diapers, and she had never once even asked him about his dating life, much less tried to set him up with someone.
She's from Texas, if you didn't notice her drawl. Doesn't have too many friends around town, lives in a little carriage house apartment down in Alexandria.
This is all interesting, Mary Pat, and she seems nice and all, but I actually had another reason for coming down. Something a little more important than my love life.
She chuckled. I doubt it.
Just wait.
They pulled into a strip mall sushi bar on Old Dominion Drive. The little restaurant was as nondescript as any eatery in the city, stuck tight between a cleaner and a bagel shop. But Mary Pat promised the sashimi was as good as Ryan would ever eat this side of Osaka. As the first customers of the day, they had their pick of tables, so Ryan chose a secluded booth in the back corner of the restaurant. They chatted about their families for a while, ordered lunch, and then Ryan pulled the two photographs from his Tumi bag, placed them side by side.
What am I looking at here, Junior?
The guy on the right is ISI, head of Joint Intelligence Miscellaneous.
Foley nodded and then said, And that's also him on the left, younger and out of uniform.
Jack nodded.
LET operative named Khalid Mir, a.k.a. Mary Pat looked up at Jack with astonishment.
Abu Kashmiri?
That's right.
I was wrong, Jack.
About?
About your love life being more interesting than what you wanted to talk about. Kashmiri was killed 3 years ago.
Or was he? Ryan asked.
Rian is Khalid Mir, and Khalid Mir is also known as Abu Kashmiri. If Rian is alive, then, to paraphrase Mark Twain, Mary Pat said, the rumors of his death have been greatly exaggerated.
Exactly.
I saw a digital image of a body, but it was after a particularly well-placed hellfire, so it could have been anybody.
That's one of the troubles with missile strikes. Unless you go in and get DNA yourself, then you never really know if you got the right person.
I guess we don't have CSI Waziristan just standing by, ready to rush to every scene and swab for evidence.
Mary Pat laughed.
I am so stealing that line.
She turned serious.
Jack, why don't I know about this Kashmiri ISI connection already?
Ryan shrugged. Jerry had directed him to keep detail of campus operations out of the conversation, so we couldn't tell her that Dom and Driscoll saw this guy in Cairo, and their photo actually made the connection in the Recog software.
Jack.
Ryan realized he was just sitting there.
Mary Pat said, let me guess. Senator Henley told you to show me the pictures, but not to reveal your shop's sources or methods that discovered the connection.
Sorry.
No need to be sorry. That's the business we're in. I respect that. But you are here for some reason other than to just show me you've made this connection, right?
Yeah.
This guy, Brigadier General Riaz Rihan. There was a sighting of him a few days ago in Cairo.
And?
He was meeting with Mustafa El-Dabousi.
Foley's eyebrows rose.
Well, that's not good. And it doesn't make a hell of a lot of sense. El-Dabousi has a benefactor already. He's Muslim Brotherhood. He doesn't need the ISI. And the ISI has militant organizations doing their bidding right there in Pakistan. Why would Rian need to go to Cairo?
Jack knew what Mary Pat Foley was thinking, but not saying.
She wasn't going to come right out and mention El-Dabousi's work on the training camps in western Libya. That was classified intelligence.
It was also something the campus had intercepted from CIA traffic to NCTC, which is how Jack knew this in the first place.
We don't know. We're surprised by it, too.
When the food came, they ate in silence for a moment while Mary Pat Foley multitasked, using her iPad to look at some sort of database. Jack assumed it was classified intelligence, but he did not ask. He felt a little uncomfortable knowing that he and his organization were, in a manner of speaking, spying on the NCTC and the work they did, but he did not dwell on it long. He needed only to look at this conversation here, where Jack and his colleagues had exploited intel derived from U.S. intelligence community sources, improved on it with their own work, and now fed the new and improved product right back to them, free of charge. The campus had been doing this for much of the past year, and it was a good relationship, even if one of the members of the romance was not aware of the other.
Mary Pat looked back to Ryan.
Well, I now know why this General Rian was not on my radar. He's not a beard.
A beard?
An Islamist in the Pakistani Defense Force. You know they are split down the middle in the army over there. The ones pushing for theocratic rule, and the ones who are still Muslim but want a nation ruled under a secular democracy. There have been two camps in Pakistan for the past 60 years. Beards is the term we use for the theocratic government proponents in the PDF.
So Rian is a secularist?
The CIA thought he was, based on what little was known about the man. Other than the name and the one photo, there is literally no bio for the guy, other than the fact he was promoted from colonel to brigadier general about a year back. Now that you have shown me that he is also Abu Kashmiri, I'm going to go out on a limb and say the CIA was wrong. Kashmiri was no secularist.
Jack sipped his Diet Coke. He wasn't sure how important this information was, but Mary Pat seemed energized by it.
Jack, I am very glad to hear you guys have been working on this.
Really? Why?
Because I was a little worried you were involved in that shootout in Paris the other day. Not you personally, of course, but Chavez and Clark. I guess if your shop is working in Cairo, then you weren't operating in Paris at the same time.
Ryan just smiled.
Hey, I can't talk about what we are and are not involved in.
Sources and methods, right?
Mary Pat Foley cocked her head a little. Jack could tell she was trying to get a read on him right now. Quickly, he changed the subject.
So, Melanie is single and she lives down in Alexandria, huh?
25. Judith Cochran took her seat at the little desk in front of the window into Saif Rahman Yassin's cell. He was still seated on his bed. He held a notepad and a pencil in his lap. Upon seeing his lawyer, he stepped up to the window and sat on his stool, bringing his pen and his pad with him. With a smile and a nod, he lifted the receiver of the red phone on the floor. Cochran said, "Good morning."
"Thank you very much for arranging for me to get some paper and a pencil."
"That was nothing. It was a reasonable request.
Still, for me, it was very nice. I am grateful."
Cochran said, "Your writ of habeas corpus was denied."
"We knew it would be, but it was a motion we had to go through."
"It is of no consequence. I did not expect them to let me walk away."
"Next, I'm going to petition the courts to allow you to..." "Do you have any ability, Miss Cochran, to draw?"
She wasn't sure she heard him correctly.
"To draw?"
"Yes."
"Well,
no, not really."
"I enjoy it very much. I studied art for a short period in England at university, and I have continued it as a pastime. Normally, I draw architecture. It fascinates me very much, the design of buildings all over the world."
Judith did not know where, if anywhere, this was going. "I can arrange perhaps some paper that is a better quality if you would like, or..."
But Yassin shook his head. "This paper is fine. In my religion, it is a sin to photograph or draw the face of any living, walking thing."
He held up the pencil in his hand as if to clarify the point.
"If you are doing it for no reason. It is not a sin if you are doing it to remember a face for some important reason."
"I see," Cochran said, but she didn't see the point in this conversation at all.
"I would like to show you some of my work, and then, perhaps, I can teach you a bit about art."
The emir reached into his notepad and pulled out four sheets that he had already torn from the pad. He held them up, one at a time, to the thick, bulletproof glass. He said,
"Judith Cochran, if you would like to assist me with my case, if your organization has any interest in holding your nation accountable to its own laws, then you will need to copy these pictures. If you work slowly on the desk there with your pen, I can watch you and help you along. We can have an art class right here."
Judith Cochran looked carefully at the drawings. They were sketches of four men. She did not recognize them, but she had no doubt that they were real people who would be recognized by anyone who knew them, so detailed and careful were the renditions.
"Who are they?" she asked,
but she feared she knew the answer.
"These are the Americans who kidnapped me. I was walking down the street in Riyadh. They came from nowhere. The young one, this man with the dark hair, he shot me. The old man, this one, was the leader."
Cochran knew the FBI men could see her through the closed-circuit camera behind her. If they were watching right now, and she was certain they were, then they would see the emir showing her pages from his pad. There was no reason for that to raise any sort of red flag, but still, she waited nervously to hear the door behind her open.
"We have been through this over and over. I can't discuss any of that with you."
"You are my lawyer, are you not?"
"I am, but..." "Judith Cochran, I have no interest in helping the United States government in a charade to convince the world I am guilty. If I cannot tell my own lawyer what has happened to me, then I..." "We have rules we must obey. Rules imposed on you by your opponent. Clearly they are..." "What is the term you use in America?" "Stacking the deck."
"Let's talk about your nutrition."
"I am not going to talk about my nutrition. It is halal. It is permissible for a Muslim to eat. Other than that, I don't care about it."
Cochran sighed, but she realized he was still holding up the pictures, and she realized she was still looking at them. Despite herself, she asked, "Are they CIA? Military? Did they tell you who they worked for?"
"They did not tell me. I assume they are in your Central Intelligence Agency, but I need you to find out."
"I can't find out."
"You can show people these pictures. There were others, but these four are the ones I remember the best. The old one who was the leader, the young one who shot me, the short foreign man with the tough eyes, and the young one with the short haircut. There was another man, a man with a beard, but I was not satisfied with my pictures of him. All the other people I came into contact with after these men, either I was wearing a hood, or they were wearing masks. I have not seen any faces since I saw these faces here, until I saw yours."
He held up the pictures again.
"These men are fixed in my memory. I will never forget them."
Cochran wanted his information. Damn the agreement she had with justice.
"All right," she said.
Listen carefully. I am working on getting a pass-through slot opened up so that we can exchange documents. I won't be able to leave with anything, though, so maybe I can bring some tracing paper in my pocket or something. I can trace your drawings and then give them back to you. The Emir said, I will work on these some more, and I will add some written details below the pictures. Height, age, anything I can think of. Good. I don't know what I will do with this information, but there is someone I can ask. You are my only hope, Judith. Please, call me Judy. Judy. I like that. Judy Cochran looked at the four pieces of white paper again. She had no way of knowing that she was looking into the faces of Jack Ryan Jr., Dominic Caruso, Domingo Chavez, and John Clark. Life at Henley Associates was returning to normal after the Paris operation. Most employees in at 8. A quick meeting in the conference room at 9, and then everyone back to their desks for a day of investigations, analysis, fishing in the murky waters of the cyber world to find the enemies of the state who lurked there. The analysts sifted through their traffic feeds, applied pattern analysis and link analysis to the data, hoping to unlock some critical piece of information America's official intelligence communities had missed, or exploit some intelligence find by American intelligence in a way the overly bureaucratic agencies could not. The field operatives spent their days testing equipment for the field, training and sifting through the analysis to look for potential operations. 2 weeks after the Paris op, Jerry Henley entered the conference room 15 minutes late. His key operatives and analysts were already there, as well as Sam Granger, director of operations. All the men were sipping coffee and chatting when he arrived.
Interesting new development. I just got a call out of the blue from Nigel Embling.
Who? Asked Driscoll.
Chavez said, XMI-6 guy in Peshawar, Pakistan. Now Driscoll remembered.
Right. He helped you and John last year when you were tracking the Emir.
Clark said,
That's right. Mary Pat Foley tipped us off to him.
Henley nodded.
But now he's coming straight to us, and he's bringing an interesting lead. He's running a source in the ISI, a major who suspects a coup is in the works. He wants to help Western powers stop it.
Shit, mumbled Caruso.
And who do you think this major's best guess is as to who is behind this coup?
The men at the table looked at one another. Finally, Jack said,
Rian? You got it.
Chavez whistled.
And why did this major tell Embling about this? Obviously he knows Nigel is a spy.
Knows or suspects. Problem for Nigel is he's not a spy. Not anymore. MI6 isn't listening to him, and he's afraid the CIA is hamstrung by the politics of the Keelty administration.
Welcome to our world, muttered Dom Caruso.
Jerry smiled but said,
So Nigel went back to Mary Pat and said, I want to talk to those guys I met with last year.
When do we go? Asked Clark. Jerry shook his head.
John, I want you to take another couple weeks off before you return to field work.
Clark shrugged.
Hey, it's your call, obviously, but I'm good to go.
Chavez disagreed.
You were healing up nicely, but a GSW is nothing to mess with. Better you stay around here. A wound infection would take you off the active roster real quick-like.
Clark said,
Guys, I'm too old to give you any macho shit about how I'm 100%. It's stiff and sore, but I sure as hell am fit enough to fly over to Peshawar and drink some tea with Embling and his new friend.
But Sam Granger made it clear the matter was not up for debate.
I'm not sending you this time, John. I can use you around here. We have some new gadgets to test out. Some remote surveillance cameras came in last night, and I'd like your input.
Clark shrugged but nodded. Clark was subordinate to Granger, and like most every military veteran, he understood the need for a command structure, whether or not he agreed with the decision.
This Embling guy, what does he know about the campus? Driscoll asked.
Nothing. Other than that, we aren't official channels. His mates at MI6 trust Mary Pat, and Mary Pat trusts us. Also, John and Ding made a good impression on him last year.
Ding smiled. We were on our best behavior.
The men laughed. Granger said, I'm going to send Sam this time. This is a one-man op. Just go over and meet with this ISI major. Get a feel for him and his story. Don't commit to anything. Just see what he will offer up. In this business, we don't trust anyone, but Embling is as solid as they come. He's also been in the game for pushing a half century, so I've got to assume he knows how to ferret out disinformation. I like our chances here, and the more we can learn about Rian, the better. The meeting broke up soon after, but Henley and Granger asked Driscoll to stay behind for a moment.
You good with this? Granger asked.
Absolutely.
Go on down to the support desk and draw your docs, cards, and cash.
Granger shook Driscoll's hand and said,
Listen, I'm not going to tell you anything you don't know here, but Peshawar is a dangerous place, and getting more dangerous by the day. I want your head on a swivel 24/7, okay?
No, Sam Granger wasn't telling Sam Driscoll anything he didn't know, but he appreciated the concern.
We're on the same page, boss. Last time I took a little vacation in Pakistan, the shit hit the fan. That's not something I'm looking to repeat this go-round.
Driscoll had gone over the border more than a year earlier, and he'd come back with a serious wound to his shoulder and a series of letters to write to the parents of his men who did not make it back. Granger nodded thoughtfully.
If there is a coup being planned by the ISI, too much digging around by an American is going to draw a lot of attention. Debrief Embling and his asset, and then come on back, okay?
Sounds good to me, said Sam.
26. Brigadier General Riaz Rehan of the Joint Intelligence Miscellaneous Division of Pakistan's Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate cut an impressive figure in the back of his silver Mercedes sedan. A lean and healthy 46 years old, Rehan was nearly 6'2", and his round face was adorned with an impressive mustache and a trim beard. He wore his military uniform on most occasions when he was in Pakistan, and he looked intimidating in it. But here in Dubai, he looked no less powerful, dressed in his Western business suit and regimental tie. Rehan's property here was a walled, two-story luxury garden villa with four bedrooms and a large pool house. It sat at the end of a long curved road on Palm Jumeirah, one of five man-made archipelagos off the coast of Dubai. Coastal property in Dubai used to be markedly scarcer, as nature blessed the emirate with only 37 miles of beaches. But the leader of Dubai did not see the geographical realities of his nation as geographical boundaries, so he began crafting his own changes to their coastline through the reclamation of land from the sea. When the five planned archipelagos were completed, more than 550 miles of coast would be added to the nation. As General Rehan's luxury vehicle turned onto Al-Kisab, a residential road of stately homes that also, when viewed from high altitude, served as the top left frond of a palm tree-shaped man-made island, Rehan took a call on his mobile. The caller was his second-in-command, Colonel Sadiq Khan.
Good morning, Colonel.
Good morning, General. The old man from Dagestan is here now.
Extend my apologies for the delay. I will be there in minutes. What is he like?
He is like my crazy old grandfather.
How do you know he does not speak Urdu?
Khan laughed. He is in the main dining room. I am upstairs, but I doubt he speaks Urdu.
Very well, Sadiq. I will meet with him and then send him on his way. I have too much to do to listen to an old man from the mountains of Russia yell at me.
Rehan hung up and looked at his watch. His Mercedes slowed on the small street to let a car from the protection detail that had been following it pass and rush ahead to the house. Rehan always traveled abroad with a security detail 12 strong. They were all ex-Special Services Group commandos, specially trained for bodyguard work by a South African firm. Still, even with this large entourage, Rehan found a way to move in a relatively low-profile manner. He ordered his men to not pack his car with bodies. Instead, his driver and his lead personal protection agent rode with him, just 3 men in his SUV. The other 10 normally stayed with him in traffic, moving around them like spokes to a hub in their unmarked and unarmored sedans. A general in the Pakistani Defense Force, even one second to the Directorate of Inter-Service Intelligence, would not normally operate from a safe house abroad, especially one with an address as opulent as Palm Jumeirah, Dubai, United Arab Emirates. But there was nothing about the life or career of Riaz Rehan that could, in any conceivable way, be considered normal. He lived and worked at the property in Palm Island because he had wealthy benefactors in the Persian Gulf who had supported him since the 1980s, and he had these benefactors because, for 30 years, Riaz Rehan had been something of a wunderkind in the world of terrorist operations. Rehan was born in Punjab, Pakistan, to a Kashmiri mother and an Afghan father. His father ran a mid-sized trucking concern in Pakistan, but he was also a devoted Islamist. In 1980, shortly after Russian Spetsnaz soldiers parachuted into Kabul and Russian ground troops rolled in to begin their occupation of Afghanistan, 14-year-old Riaz traveled with his father to Peshawar to help organize convoys to resupply the Mujahideen fighting over the border. Rehan's father used his own resources and personality to assemble a convoy of light weapons, rice, and medicine for the Afghan rebels. He left his son behind in Peshawar and set off to return to the country of his birth with his load. Within days, Rian's father was dead, blown to bits during a Russian airstrike on his convoy in the Khyber Pass. Young Riaz learned of his father's death, and then he went to work. He organized, assembled, and led the next shipment of weapons over the border himself on a donkey caravan that bypassed the highway of death that the Khyber Pass had become, instead heading north over the mountains of the Hindu Kush into Afghanistan. It was only the hubris of the young and his faith in Allah that sent him through the mountains in February, but his caravan arrived unscathed. And although it delivered nothing more than old British Army Lee Enfield rifles and winter blankets for the Mujahideen, ISI leadership soon learned of the bold actions of the young boy. By his third trip over the mountains, the ISI was helping him with intelligence on Russian forces in his area, and within months, powerful and wealthy Wahhabi Arabs from oil-rich Gulf states were footing the bill for his shipments. By the time he was 16, Riaz was leading huge convoys with Kalashnikov rifles and 7.62 ammunition over the border to the rebels, and by 1986, when the American CIA delivered the first lot of shoulder-fired Stinger missiles to Peshawar to the ISI entrusted the 20-year-old operative from Kashmir with getting the high-tech weapons over the border and into the hands of the missile crews, who'd already been trained and were now just waiting for their launchers. By the time the war ended, the ISI had Rian pegged as a prime candidate to be a top-flight international operative, so they sent him to school in Saudi Arabia to improve his Arabic, and then to London to properly westernize himself and study engineering. After London, he joined the Pakistani Defense Forces Officer Corps, rose to the rank of captain, and then left the military to become an agent of, but not an employee of, the ISI. Rian was used by Pakistani intelligence for recruiting, organizing, and orchestrating the operations of the smaller terror groups active on Pakistani soil. He served as something of a liaison between ISI leadership and the criminal and ideological groups who fought against India, the West at large, and even Pakistan's own secular government. Riaz Rian was not a member of any of the jihadist organizations with whom he worked, not the Umayyad Revolutionary Council, not Al-Qaeda, not Lashkar-e-Taiba, not Jaish-e-Mohammed. No, he was a freelancer, a contract employer, and he was the man who translated the general interests and goals of the Pakistani Islamist leadership into actions on the ground, in the trenches. He worked with 24 different Islamist militant groups, all based in Pakistan. And to do this, he adopted 24 different cover identities. To Lashkar-e-Taiba, he was Abu Kashmiri. To Jaish-e-Mohammed, he was Khalid Mir. He was, in effect, 25 people, including his given name, and this made him virtually impossible for Indian and Western intelligence agencies to track. His personal security was also helped along by the fact that he was neither fish nor fowl, not a member of a terror group, and not a member of the Pakistani intelligence services. Terror cells acting under his patronage executed missions in Bali, Jakarta, Mumbai, New Delhi, Baghdad, Kabul, Tel Aviv, Tanzania, Mogadishu, Chittagong, and all over Pakistan itself. In December 2007 in Rawalpindi, Riaz Rian conducted his biggest operation, though no more than a handful of upper-level ISI and PDF generals knew about it. Rian himself selected, trained, and handled the assassin of Pakistani Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto on behalf of the Ministry of Defense and the ISI. And in true, cold, calculating Rian fashion, he also selected the man who stood behind the gunman, the man who blew the assassin up, along with a sizable portion of the crowd, with a suicide vest, right after the Prime Minister had been shot, to ensure that these dead men would indeed tell no tales. It was crucial to the leaders in Pakistani intelligence, who use the jihadist groups and criminal gangs as proxy fighters, that they keep their hands clean, and Rian was the cutout who helped them do just that. For Rian himself to stay clean as the cutout, they put great resources into his personal and operational security. Rian's contacts in the Arab world, wealthy oil sheiks in Qatar and the UAE whom he had known since the war with Russia in Afghanistan, began to sponsor him to further insulate and protect him. He was bankrolled by these wealthy Wahhabis, and eventually, in 2010, he returned to the Pakistani army at the rank of Brigadier General, simply because his powerful Arab friends demanded of the ISI that Rian be given a senior operating role in the nation's intelligence structure. The Islamist generals put him in charge of Joint Intelligence Miscellaneous, a role normally given to a higher-ranking major general. This handed over to Riyan the responsibility for all international espionage assets and operations. His benefactors in the UAE, those who knew him, or more precisely knew of him, since his days as a teenager humping mule trains over the mountains, solidified their special relationship with Riyan by giving him access to a walled compound on Dubai's Palm Islands. This became, for all intents and purposes, his office. Yes, he had an office in Islamabad, at the beautifully maintained headquarters of the Directorate of Inter-Services Intelligence in Abhara. But as often as not, he was in Dubai, away from those in the government of Pakistan who did not know he existed, or in the army of Pakistan who did not support his goal for a caliphate, and away from those few in the ISI who actively sought to bring him down. General Riyan arrived at his compound a short time after his call with Colonel Khan, and a few minutes after that, he sat across the table from Suleiman Murshidov, the venerable spiritual leader of Jamaat Shariat of Dagestan. The old man must have been 80, Riyan thought, as he looked at eyes milky from cataracts and skin like beach sand blown into folds by the wind. He was of the mountains of the Caucasus, and Riyan assumed he had never been to Dubai, had never seen skyscrapers higher than the squat Soviet-era concrete monoliths in Makhachkala, and had never met with a person in power in a foreign intelligence organization. A few of Riyan's officers and guards stood around the dining room, and the old man was in the company of four others, all younger, some much more so. They didn't look like security, more like sons and grandsons. They also appeared as if they were here under duress. Perspiration glistened on their foreheads, and they glanced around at the armed security walking the grounds in the house, as if they might, at any moment, be taken prisoner by these dark-skinned men. The Dagestani spiritual leader had asked for this meeting several days ago, and Riyan knew why. The general thought it was childish, really. Riyan had been traveling the world in the past few months, meeting with insurgent groups and international terror outfits in Egypt, Indonesia, Saudi Arabia, Iran, Chechnya, and Yemen. But he had bypassed Dagestan. Jamaat Shariat, the main Dagestani Islamist group, took a back seat to the Chechens in the eyes of Riyan and his men. More so now that Jamaat Shariat had lost the commander of their armed wing, Israfil Nabayev. But even before Nabayev had been captured by the Russians, Riyaz Riyan had not bothered to include the Dagestanis in his meetings. The Chechens worked with the Dagestanis, so he had met only with the Chechens. And now, Riyan assumed, the Dagestanis were mad, offended at the slight. They had sent their spiritual leader here to explain that they were still viable, and only Jamaat Shariat spoke for Dagestan, blah, blah, blah. Riyan looked at the old man across the table. The Pakistani general was sure he was about to be lectured by this holy man from the mountains. Everyone in the room spoke Arabic. Riyan greeted the contingent from Dagestan, asked after their needs, and inquired about their journey. With the niceties out of the way, Riyan was anxious to finish his morning meeting. How may I be of service to you today? Murshidov said, I am told by my friends in Chechnya that you are a man of God. Riyan smiled. I am a humble follower. My people have been dealt a painful blow with the capture of Israfil Nabayev. I have seen this. I know he was a valiant commander of your troops. In truth, Riyan did not think much of the Dagestanis. He knew the Chechens better, had more respect for their abilities as fighters. Still, this Nabayev fellow had impressed the Chechens. They said he was supposedly a cut above the other Dagestani fighters who'd been, by Riyan's way of thinking, little more than cannon fodder for the Russians. Murshidov nodded, appreciative of the kind words. He was my great hope for the future of my people. But without him, I believe now we must look outward for assistance. Oh, so there is a pitch to be made today. Riyan was pleased. If this old man needed something, then maybe he wouldn't have to sit through a tongue-lashing. I am at your service. How can I help you? The Chechens say you will soon lead Pakistan. Riyan's face remained impassive. But inside him, his blood began to boil. He had sworn all the attendees at his meetings to secrecy. That is premature. Right now the situation is difficult for... But the old man kept talking, almost as if he were talking to himself and did not know Riyan was in the room with him. You have told the Chechens you will gain control of nuclear weapons, and you have offered these weapons to the Chechens. They have refused you,
because they are afraid that if they possessed nuclear weapons, they would become a nuclear target themselves.